This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books Network. I am your host, Erica Monahan, and today I have the pleasure of interviewing Christian Raffensperger about a newly edited volume that is just out. The title of the volume is Authorship, Worldview, and Identity in Medieval Europe. Christian Raffensperger is the Kenneth E. Ray Chair in Humanities at Wittenberg University in the USA and Professor and Chair of the History Department. Christian has written two monographs. His first monograph was a 2012 book, Reimagining Europe, Kiev and Rus and the Medieval World. In 2018, he came out with a second monograph entitled Conflict, Bargaining, and Kinship Networks in Medieval Eastern Europe. Along the way, he has also co-edited two volumes of collected essays, which are wonderful. One was Portraits of Medieval Eastern Europe, 800 to 1300, co-edited with Donald Ostrowski. And this is a wonderful volume that provides portraits of medieval individuals. And I have found it to really resonate in the undergraduate classroom. So I am delighted to recommend that to people. And your other edited volume is Radical Traditionalism, The Influence of Walter Kagi in Late Antique, Byzantine, and Medieval History, which you co-edited with David Ulster. Christian has also written a number of scholarly articles, as well as some pieces for the popular press. Back in 2016, some of our readers may have encountered this. He wrote a piece in the Monkey Cage at the Washington Post about Ukraine's EU association agreement. This was when the issue was revisited in 2016, and you wrote a powerful piece there. And I'll also note that since the invasion, Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, you've written several pieces offering historical perspective for various local newspaper outlets, which is such an important thing to do. So thank you very much for all that you've done, all that you continue to do, and thank you for spending an hour here with us to talk about this latest book, Christian.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Thanks. All right. Well, we always start our New Books Network's interviews, or at least I do, with the question of how did you become a historian? Please tell us a little bit about your path into history.
My path actually began, a long time ago because I was a little kid who played with knights and castles. And I just was fascinated by the Middle Ages through that aspect. And then when I got into high school, it was during the time the Soviet Union was beginning to fall apart under Gorbachev. And we had a Russian teacher. And so I took Russian, and those paths continued very separately, Russian and then medieval Europe, until I got to college and I took a upper-level seminar class with Michael Jones at Bates College on the Vikings, and I learned about the Vikings in Eastern Europe. And all of a sudden, there was this synchronicity between my interests. I didn't pursue it immediately. I went and worked for a while, and then I decided, I wanted to go into higher education. And so I went to graduate school, and I really thought, this is what I wanted to do, and I wanted to teach people about these things that I had discovered, and that's what I've ended up doing. And so, it's really worked out nicely for me. I get to do what I love.
Super, super. Yeah, that is great. All right. And then the next question, which we typically ask, and I want to ask you, is I want to ask you, why did you write this book? But given that this is an edited collection, I want to pause a bit more on how you, as the editor, who you didn't write the individual pieces, but you conceived of this project, you edited and worked with all of these authors, and you brought this project to fruition. And I find this book to be so rich. It cuts in a variety of directions that I found really worth thinking about. And so I want to spend a little bit more time on this kind of the project, how you see it as a whole. And one example, for example, is I like how you point out in your introduction that the AHR, the flagship journal of the American Historical Association, has published on its website that it is consciously trying to broaden its coverage. And it put it in these terms, and you quote it in the article that, quote, "For much of its history, the AHR published essays primarily on the history of North America and Western Europe." And it goes on and says, "And it is now looking to expand its coverage and actively encourages," now I'm quoting in, "the submission of manuscripts on Africa, Asia, Oceania, Latin America, and the Middle East." And in that capacious list of geographic spaces, there is no Eastern Europe.
That's right.
And so I want to ask you to say more about the place of Eastern Europe in medieval Europe and medieval history here, please.
Yeah, so this, and I'm so glad that you noted that, because that's one of these funny things that, the AHR editors have no ill intent whatsoever. They're simply trying to follow along with this current trend, much needed to try and expand historical coverage. But the lacuna is pretty obvious when you list all those places as you did, and you just don't have Eastern Europe. When I started my academic career with Reimagining Europe, what I wanted was to bring Rus into medieval Europe. And then as I kept reading and kept writing, what I found is it's not just Rus. Basically, medieval Europe ends at the Elbe, as far as the majority of what we call medievalists in the Anglophone world are concerned. And so, this leads me back to your initial question about authorship, worldview, and identity and how it was conceived. And so this is a title that, we workshopped with the publisher. Rutledge has just been amazing. My editor there, Michael, has been fantastic. And I like it. But in my head, I still call this book Medieval's Worldview, as in the possessive peoples, medievals, their worldview. And the reason I call it that is because for a long time, I've picked on a very popular medieval European history textbook published by Oxford University Press called The Medieval Worldview. And the medieval worldview is pretty easy to pick on because it has got three really beautiful full-page, two-page spread maps. And on the left side of the page is Western Europe, and you've got all the cities in France and southern England, some cities in the German Empire and Italy, and then the entire right hand is empty. And so you see these maps, and I've used them in a number of publications, and you see these maps, and it's like, why did you even include a two-page spread? If you are the audience of this book, undergraduate students, and you're looking at these maps of medieval Europe, your impression is very clearly that medieval Europe is populated in the West and utterly depopulated in the East. And, you know, it might sound like I'm exaggerating, but certainly I'm not. You know, you can go look at these maps and you see Poland, Bohemia, Hungary is in early medieval Europe, and those are just labels. But then in high medieval Europe, even those labels disappear. Although we do get Prague as a city, and then everything else is gone. My Rus, for instance, is under the key. They put the key right where Rus is. So there is this impression given that medieval Eastern Europe, and really I mean by that small e as in directional, not capital E Eastern as in, you know, the concept of Eastern Europe, but the Eastern half of Europe is empty. It's terra incognita. And the text of the book, you know, follows along in this. And there are a few mentions of Eastern Europe, but the few mentions of Eastern Europe in that book are generally to prove a modern point. So the author will talk about the religious divide as mirroring the Iron Curtain, or the religious divide in the Balkans as mirroring the Balkan Wars of the 1990s. You know, it's not there for its own historical purpose as the history of France or England is there. And so, you know, I've talked so much about this, and I thought what we really need to do is we need to go back to our primary sources. And I published a piece a few years ago in a volume called The Medieval Networks in East Central Europe. And that piece, which does have those maps in it as well, talked about this idea that what we should do is we should go back to our primary sources and see how they conceptualize the world. And this was, you know, riffing on an idea. And then after a couple years, I thought, okay, you know what? That's actually a pretty good idea. I don't have it in me to do all of that. You know, let's get some people together and let's have them talk about their favorite source or one of the sources they use the most. And how did that primary author conceptualize their world, right? And so that's what the edited collection came to be, is how do those medieval people view the world around them?
Okay. And that is what you're talking about. There's a spot in the introduction where you're laying out the goals and also get into the methodology a bit. And I'll just even quote this because the passage stuck out for me. And you write, "This volume attempts to correct, or at least challenge, the construct that is medieval Europe by going back to the primary sources, the building blocks upon which the story of medieval Europe rests. Though it is an approach reliant upon returning to the sources, this volume has no intention of replicating the style of history made famous by Leopold von Ranke so many years ago." And so you talked about the goal, and now I want to ask you to just say a little bit more about this method of bringing us to the sources, but not in the way that von Ranke did.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that I have done in my 15 plus years at Wittenberg is teach our methods classes. And the methods classes for history majors always include, you know, the requisite historiography and going back to Ranke and what the idea, the Rankean idea that if you just read all of the sources, you can combine the true fact of history. And, you know, certainly we are well past that. And we are, post-postmodern historians for the most part at this point. But anytime you say, go back to the sources to historians, especially to medieval historians, there is an immediate knee-jerk reaction of like, oh, wait, nope, this is a 19th century thing that you're doing. And so I felt like I had to really put that in there, that it is not. We're utilizing very modern methodologies in the book. And, you know, you see that in a variety of places, not only through the inclusion of material culture. You know, Jitzke Jasperza has a wonderful piece about the treasuries, the Guelph treasuries, and then the treasury in San Isidoro. But, you know, Stacey Morell's piece also is fantastic in this regard. But I really thought it was important to acknowledge up front that we were not trying to use some kind of recidivist methodology to go back to the past, but instead we were trying to utilize the sources to go forward into the future. And I think it's really important to try and do that for all kinds of things and let the sources speak, and not in a negative way, right? Not, you know, that they will tell us the truth, but, you know, and I mentioned this in the introduction, you know, Lisa Wolverton has an amazing book on Cosmos at Prague, where instead of, you know, mining Cosmos's narrative for information about medieval Bohemia, instead she's writing about Cosmos the author and what the author's intention was for his work. And it really changes the way we look at Cosmos and Cosmos's text, rather than looking up a date in it or, you know, what did this king do or that king do. If we can understand the authors and their authorial intent, which is, again, a very postmodern way of looking at things, I think that will help us understand this worldview construction that the book is trying to get at.
Thank you so much. And yes, that is one of the things that I found so rich in this book, that cuts in a variety of really valuable directions. And so we've talked about Eastern Europe and in Eastern medieval Europe, but the volume isn't just about Eastern Europe. These 17 articles take us, in addition to Kiev and the Baltics the Baltic states and the Balkans, we also see texts and people from Scandinavia, Iberia, the Mediterranean, and even Western Europe. And actually, that's a good segue to get right into the meat of the volume. We won't have time to discuss everything in here, so hopefully readers will, you know, listen to this and then go and get their hands on Authorship, Worldview, and Identity in Medieval Europe, but to talk about just a few of the pieces. So the first article in the volume is by Aaron Thomas Daly, and he has this piece, The Horizons of Gregory Tours. So here you've got this person very much from Western Europe, right? Please tell us a bit about this piece and how this piece about from someone from what's now France serves the purposes of this project.
Yeah, Erica, I really appreciate you asking that and pointing out that it does encompass all of medieval Europe, because that was a very intentional goal. And, you know, one of the things that I really am trying to do with a lot of my scholarship, and this book really was a way to start that, was to look at medieval Europe more broadly. And part of that is because, you know, I've got a pretty reliable audience who will read stuff on Rus, right? But, you know, my good friend Amy Livingstone, for instance, who's a historian of the Loire Valley and now has moved to Brittany, she is not going to read a book on Rus necessarily. But she's a medievalist, and she is somebody I want to be reading my work and exchanging ideas with. And so my work needs to be about all of medieval Europe. And so that's why I tried to include such a broad territory here. And Aaron Daly's piece is a great example of that, because Gregory of Tours is just symbolic for early medieval Europe in so many ways. And his history, right, or history of the Franks, as it's often been called, is used for so much of understanding the Merovingian world and the early Christianization and all kinds of topics. It's been used in feud literature. It's been used in women's studies for understanding all of these powerful women and then the stereotypes about powerful women. But what Aaron does in his piece that I think is so fascinating is he points out that actually Gregory lives in a much bigger world than Francia. He talks about saints both living and dead in the Middle East. He talks about India. He talks about these enormous horizons because the world he lives in is Christendom. And yet the vast majority of uses that Gregory has been put to are relatively narrow, right? They're relatively confined to the horizons of medieval Western Europe or early medieval Western Europe. But as Aaron read through this text and then narrated this information for us, picking out these examples, you know, we've got all sorts of things from the Eastern Mediterranean. We've got all sorts of things, both, again, living and dead. So this is not just going back to biblical times, but current things during Gregory's period that are going on in the Eastern Mediterranean that show us his awareness of and his conceptualization of a much wider world than we traditionally think of Gregory as living in.
Thank you. And you know what, actually, this reminds me that I want to come back to your own previous work that led you up to doing this volume? That because as you know, as I listen to you speak, yes, it makes so much sense that people living in Gaul and what's now France might, if we are open to the possibilities when we read their work, we could get real clues about how big or where their worlds stretched, which is what I see this book doing. And in one of the reasons it makes sense that it turns out some of those worlds of so many medievals stretched farther than, say, that traditional textbook that you talked about might lead us to believe. One of the reasons we can appreciate that it goes farther, I think, is because of your earlier work. And so I looked through and I noticed there isn't an NBN interview on it, I wanted to ask you to tell us a little bit about your first two books. They are very much part of this project. Your first book, Reimagining Europe, Kiev and Rus and the Medieval World. And then your second book on kinship networks. In some ways, this is super unfair of me to just pop on you, but in a paragraph or so, will you tell us what you do in those books and how it helps us understand that that the connections were wider than just Western Europe?
Absolutely. Well, and I don't think it's super unfair of you, but I'm also, Erica, going to pick on NBN, if that's all right, for just a minute, because I think one of the reasons that there isn't an NBN interview is because my work falls between categories. And categories, or silos, as I often talk about them, are really what define the academic world. And so you and I know each other from the Slavic studies world. And so I fit into the Slavic studies world as part of this early part of Slavic studies. You're more in a Muscovite period of Slavic studies. And then I go to medieval studies conferences where I'm off at the Eastern fringe, or Byzantine studies conferences where I'm part of a Northern fringe. But, you know, traditional medieval studies, I don't really fit into, and traditional Slavic studies, I don't really fit into, which is more, you know, imperial or Soviet. So, you know, my work exists in a really weird intersection that is neither a Slavic silo, a Byzantine silo, or a medieval silo, but is intentionally trying to bridge many of those different things. So, you know, that's maybe two paragraphs more than you wanted, but coming back to Reimagining Europe, I mean, Reimagining Europe from 2012 was a book where I was trying to integrate Rus into medieval Europe, and I was trying to do it through a few different categories. One of those was to get rid of this idea of the Byzantine Commonwealth. And, you know, it's interesting because art historians at the time told me, oh, you know, that's a straw man. The Byzantine Commonwealth is dead. But it's not dead. It's really not dead at all, especially for historians and especially for medievalists who still use it all the time. And so I wanted to talk about something alternate, which was the Byzantine ideal, which is that Byzantium, or the medieval Roman Empire, as I call it more often these days, was the ideal empire, and everybody was looking to appropriate from it. And the Ottonians did that. We see that at Monte Cassino in the Italian peninsula. We even see that in the Arabic and Turkic world as well. And yet, because of Obolensky and because of a variety of other scholars, we've singled out the Slavic appropriations as different or special and divided that off. And that is not surprisingly matches very nicely to the Iron Curtain. So situating Rus in that broader world of we're all appropriating from Byzantium takes away some of that otherness. I also looked at dynastic marriages and the marriages that were made between the Rusian royal family and the rest of medieval Europe. And, you know, this is something that, for instance, in that Slavic studies silo, if you go back to Kiev and Russia, which is, you know, a classic book of that world, these marriages are dismissed in just a few sentences. They don't really appear in Western medieval things unless it's Anna Yaroslavna, who is married to Henry of France, and then, you know, she's othered for a variety of reasons. So I really focus on those marriages as a way to tie Rus into medieval Europe. And then I also talked about their religious ties, because that's one of the things that often Rus is discussed as converting to Christianity in 988 with Byzantium. You get a marriage between Volodymyr and Anna. And then you get the next discussion is about Ivan III and Sophia Palaiologina, which is 400 years later. And you see this Byzantine connection, right, for Rus. But in the 10th and 11th and 12th centuries, you know, the Russian world existed as part of a larger Christian world. And we see that with the marriages. We see that with taking in saints' lives and celebrations of saints, from Pope Urban II's celebration of the translation of the relics of St. Nicholas, for instance, all kinds of connections. And so that's, you know, reimagining Europe in a nutshell. I mean, it's a big nut. It's like a coconut shell. I'm sorry, Erica.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, but it, I mean, it is such a great book. I mean, when I read, 54 marriages into Western Europe over this, you know, century and a half or so, was it? It's been a while since I've read it, but it's remarkable work, and that we should all know about. Actually, though, and I want to that you talk about these historical silos, and I want to say NBN is trying to do its part in addressing that, and so you've given me this chance to just plug for a minute, and maybe I can, you know, we can have another conversation in that New Books Network, in conjunction with Critica. I've just been involved in founding a series called History X Silo. And the idea is exactly what you talk about, that so often as historians, we only talk to each other or this particular community. And the idea of History X Silo is to try and get historians talking across our subfields. So listeners, I encourage them to, you know, put in search History X Silo. We're just starting to do interviews now. Christian, I can talk to you more about that as well. Although, even though I think that the sense in which you used, our silos is that some of this work, like medieval marriages from the Royal House of Kiev landing in Western Europe, has in many ways just fallen out of the picture for so many people. And your work is so important in bringing that back in.
Hold on, before you go on, though, I would note, yes, absolutely. I've got one scheduled for August. It was supposed to be February, but it's gotten pushed back. So you can hear me on that, too.
Oh, super, super. Okay, great. All right.
With Joanna Drell.
Oh, all right. All right, good. Yay. All right. Now, next, because I currently in my own research, I actually wanted to say, I really, so much of what you're saying resonates so much with what I would consider my intellectual agenda of really integrating, you know, places east of the Elbe into a broader context. And for me, the period I focus on most is the early modern period and the, you know, 15 to 1800. But I think that this kind of approach can, you know, that we have a lot of work to do in our respective fields in that direction. So I am with you on that one. And so because I spend time, so much of my time in my own research, thinking about people who traversed Eurasia before there were modern maps to do it, I wanted to ask you about this article about Marco Polo, one of those, you know, intrepid travelers. So it's Teresa Shawcross has an article, The Worldview of Marco Polo's Divisamento du Monde, his the currency of the world, commercial marvels, Silk Route nostalgia, and global empire in the late Middle Ages. So we've all heard the name Marco Polo, probably know a little bit, we think, about him. But I wanted to ask you to tell us a little bit about this article, and what does this article achieve that's been missing, that's a new contribution in your perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to do that. I would also add a parenthetical that I agree absolutely that your work does the same sort of thing, especially, you know, I'm moving beyond the Elbe and you're moving us beyond the Urals. And, you know, I am trying so hard to integrate, you know, all of that material into the Imperial Russian things and not just talk about a European focus. So I appreciate that very much. So for Teresa's article, Shawcross's article, she's trying to look at Marco Polo in a very different way than is traditionally done. And she's focused on, as the title indicates, or the subtitle indicates, the commercial implications. And so she's reading it via the commercial implications and saying, this is what Marco Polo was focused on. And within that, we see an analysis of the mercantile community of Byzantium and the mercantile community of the Mongol world and how that fits into the Italian city-states and how those compare one to another. And so within that, she can really get at a whole variety of topics that have been a little bit hidden before because that divisement was being used for a different purpose. And it's really interesting to think, and actually, you know, so many of these things in this volume worked out very nicely. And I can't take credit for that. You know, the authors did all the work, but they worked out so nicely in resonating one with another, getting back to that idea of what was the authorial intent. And, you know, of course, we could go into a long thing about who was the author of that particular text, but the text itself's purpose, Teresa Shawcross points out, is maybe not what we've often thought it was, and that we learned so much instead about the way that Marco Polo and the Polos in general viewed their world via this mercantile interaction rather than, you know, the othering of, look at this crazy stuff that I'm seeing out in the world, or, you know, look at what I can pull out of this text about race or ethnicity or religion. And so it's a It, and again, it feels like, you know, a new focus, but it's a new focus on a topic that we often consider to be an old topic, which is mercantile history or economic history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even that she calls that in this text, you know, one of the marvels identified actually turns out to be, you know, a European at a distant court. And so that was, so it's not just about some really othered exotica in some ways.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
I like that piece a lot. And well, let's see. The other piece that, you know, as a historian of early modern Russia, that definitely you know, jumped out to me, and I wanted to ask you about is this article. There's an article in the volume by Ines Garcia de la Puente called "Imagined Geographies in Early Rus," and in it she writes. She's talking about sort of, in put crudely, you know, what can we learn about geography from the primary chronicle? And she said, which is the, you know, kind of, well, I'll let you give us a primer for readers and listeners that don't know on the primary chronicle. But so she writes, by explaining where the land of Rus came from and describing its territory, the primary chronicle engages in a process of symbolic interpretation rather than of objective representation. Perhaps foreseeably, the textual map that transpires from its pages imagines geography rather than pictures it. And as I was reading this article, at some albeit minuscule level, I just couldn't help but wonder that if Vladimir Putin, who has fancied himself a student of history, had read this sort of material in his syllabi, perhaps, I mean, could he have come to some different conclusions? I don't, given what we've seen, hold up much hope. But I wanted to ask you to tell us a bit about this piece and how it speaks to the volume's main goals.
Yeah, absolutely. I really like this one, of course, because, you know, I do medieval Eastern Europe and medieval Rus in particular. And so instead of inserting myself into the volume, I really wanted to get a great scholar who would do good work. And Inez certainly blew me away with that, because she brings in all kinds of things here that is literature and scholarship that I don't do, and ways that I don't think about this history. And I really like this piece in so many ways, because she goes through and she talks about the construction, and it is a construction of the world as viewed by the author or the authors of this text. And this text we call the Povest Vremenik Liat, the Tale of Bygone Years, perhaps is one way to translate it. That is the earliest text that we have from Rus, and it narrates the history kind of from the flood, but really mostly from the 10th and 11th into the very early 12th century. And we see a lot of narrative information in there. We see a lot of analytical information or analytic, pardon me, information. But in the early stages, which is what she's talking about, we see the writer try and conceive of how does Rus fit into a Christian world. And there is some reliance on biblical information from George Hamartolus, John Malalas, and it's possible that there is some borrowing directly from those texts, and we see that. But we also get, you know, this narrative of creation from Genesis, and we get the division of the world among the sons of Noah. And the world that ends up being created is not one that is creating itself as an Eastern European other. It's connected to the Byzantine world, of course. It's connected to the Middle East, but it's also connected to the Slavic world because we've got all of these other Slavic connections. And so we see mentions of the Moravians and Bulgarians, the Croats, the Liaks, how the Poles are referred to. But we also see that the chronicler connects the travels of St. Andrew through the land of Rus, and he has St. Andrew travel through the land of Rus as a way to reach Rome. And this is such an odd thing. I mean, you know, I can almost imagine, you know, booking this on Expedia, but it would be, you know, Constantinople to Kiev to Novgorod, and then around Europe to Rome. No way that's the easiest way to go. But the chronicler used this as a way to almost delineate the known world, including Rus, as part of that wider Christian world. And so I think that's really important to think about. The chronicler, almost certainly he, but he used these you know, boundaries too, the Caspian, the Ural Mountains, you know, these other boundaries to conceptualize that known and unknown that makes Rus part of a Christian world, right? Not necessarily defined as a European world.
Thank you so much for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, can I add one thing to that too, which is that, you know, I love your question or your thought about Vladimir Putin, because this is one of the things I think about as well when I give talks on the Ukraine war. I have a small book that came out in January called From Kiev and Rus to Ukraine, Past is Present. And it's from a German publisher in their Zeitenspiegel series. And it's one of these, you know, small format, you know, 30,000 word books. And it talks about the Ukraine war as a bookend, introduction and conclusion. And then in the middle is a potted history of Rus, talking about all of these interconnections, making Rus part of medieval Europe. And so, I mean, it is really trying to shape this narrative that if we view the past differently, as moderns, as present people, if we view the past differently such that Rus and modern-day Ukraine is part of Europe, that changes how we conceptualize what Europe is and the way and the ways in which we care about medieval Europe as well.
Yes. So, and also I thank you so much for that. And breaking down what, you know, any understanding of what's primordial perhaps is another aspect I appreciated. But thank you for so you have a book that just came out in that I didn't mention in the beginning. My apologies for that. And yes, please tell us again the title.
From Kiev and Rus to Ukraine, Past is Present.
Super. Thank you very much. Oh, that's great. Well, so actually, we don't have a whole lot. I don't want to keep you too much, but so far we've talked about some of the articles that are in the first part of the book. And the first part of the book, the articles, is listed under this section titled A Wider World. And in the second part of the book, there's a series of articles on that. The title there is neighbors and neighborhoods. And I just thought that one of the articles that I wanted, that I thought I might ask you about, because it has this great methodology of looking at vernacular in the use of vernacular in administrative documents. And it was Frederick Soup, I think. And he has this article, "The Medieval Welsh Ethnic Nicknames and Implications for the Welsh View of Their Geopolitical Context since 1050 to 1400. Could you tell us a bit about that article, what's going on in there, and how that serves the volume's purposes?
Yeah, so, you know, anytime you try and create an edited collection, table of contents or structure, you have to try and think about, okay, so am I just going to throw all this in there, or is there going to be some organizing principle? And if so, what is that organizing principle? And so I tried to create an organizing structure that was sources that are very outward looking and then sources that are more inward looking. And it doesn't always fit, right? I mean, you know, there are a couple texts that are really right on the border. And so I put one at the end of the first section and one right at the beginning of the second section. But Frederick's text absolutely is one of these that is much more inward looking about its own neighborhood, right? And so what he's talking about are nicknames, which is something I've never thought about. And so I was just really bowled over when I got this information from him and read through this, because I'd been reading a little bit about medieval Wales, you know, Stevenson's work, but I hadn't thought about any of these issues. And so, you know, what Fred does in here is he looks at the terms that get used for ethnic nicknames. So Sais, right, is one of these nicknames that gets used pretty often. And we see in there that Sais, S-A-I-S, and I apologize, I don't actually speak Welsh, and so I'm probably mispronouncing that, but gets used for English, right? So as somebody who is from England. And so we see the inclusion of this nickname, Sais, in 23 instances in one place and 10 instances in another. And it's always like, you know, so-and-so the English, Griffith Sais, right? Griffith the English. And it is a way to other and connect Griffith, which is a good proper Welsh name, with the English. And then we see the same thing literally when we get to Gwydel, right? And then we get this Gwydel nickname, and it's a label for an Irishman. And so we see this Gwydel nickname for people who are of Irish and descent. And already from the 11th and 12th century, we see these labels as ways to identify the ethnicity of somebody that is creating them as other than native in our sources. And I just thought that was so fascinating and embedded in documentary sources, but pulled out in a way that we never would have thought about in the past, or at least I don't think we would have. And going back to an earlier question, Erica, you know, this is one of the reasons I put in the bit about Ranke, is because, yes, we are going back to the sources, but we're looking at the sources with all of these new lenses that you know, we didn't have 200 years ago. And this is one of those great places where, you know, nobody actually thought about these nicknames in the way that Fred is doing. And so I think this is a really clever way to try and get at the sources, author's view of their world around them.
Thank you. And I also just thought that it is such a great way of illustrating how identity is constructed at multiple scales. And I think that this volume does a really nice job of presenting that.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Well, listen, we could talk about all of them, but I said I wouldn't keep you too long. And so with that, I'm going to just encourage our readers to, you know, medievalists and people that study worldviews and identity and issues of authorship. Really, I think you'll find it worth your while to peruse the articles in this wonderful volume. So thank you again for doing it. But before I let you go, I want to thank you for your time. And our final NBN question tends to be, what are you working on next? What's your next project? What are you working on now?
Do you want what I'm writing or what's going to come out soon?
Both.
Okay. Well, there are a couple things that are coming out soon, but the one I'd like to mention is a book called Rulers and Rulership in the Arc of Medieval Europe. And this is an attempt to reconceptualize how we think about rulers and rulership, taking England not as normative, but as abnormal, and instead focusing on the ways that we see rulers and rulership in a territory that stretches from Iberia, north to Ireland, across Scandinavia, and down through Central and Eastern Europe to Byzantium, the medieval Roman Empire. And if we look at that territory, which is the territory that is most of Europe, what's going on there? And let's look at what's going on there and see, is that the same as what we've constructed as our normative view based on England? And it turns out it's not. I mean, perhaps not surprisingly. And so it's a way to get at a new view of how we understand medieval Europe as a broader perspective. So that comes out in August. What I'm writing right now is a collective biography of a queen of Rus. And we don't have enough information to write a book about. You know, we've got no Eleanor of Aquitaine or Urraca of Leon Castile. So I'm writing a collective biography where we've got bits and pieces about all kinds of different women, and it's going to follow a life cycle. And so we'll learn about their marriages, their faith, their death, their political activities, all of these sorts of things.
Oh, that sounds fascinating. They both sound terrific, and I will really look forward to reading this and potentially assigning a book about medieval queenship. I'm really thank you for doing that. Thank you for sharing it. All right, then. Again, just thank you so much for your expertise, your work, and for spending this hour with us. Congratulations on all these wonderful publications that you have made happen. And I look forward to the next interview, Christian.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.